Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Good evening, everyone on the East Coast, and good afternoon to those of you on the West Coast. Hello to everyone in between. This is Michael Charney. I'm here tonight with co-host Eric Beiler, as we are every Tuesday at this time, on the Middle Ground. This week, of course, it's the Democratic National Convention, and Eric is actually there, and we're going to speak with him in just a few minutes. He's also lined up a number of guests for us. So for us, this is pretty exciting. I mean, I guess if you're a political junkie, every 4 years, you get this political high out of the election season, and it sort of all comes to fruition at the conventions. Last week, we had the Republican convention as well, which I commented on, was filled with what I refer to as Pinocchio moments. Although there were a number of very interesting speeches as well, and of course, we had one rather unusual conversation between an old man and an empty chair, which has led not only to an entirely new Twitter tag called Eastwooding, for those of you who are not aware of it, but has also started a campaign to see whether or not they can get Betty White to the Democratic National Convention to do a rebuttal of some kind. There's a Facebook page, Get Betty White to the DNC, I believe it's called, and it went up 4 days ago, I think, and it's already well north of 30,000 likes. It's been the story's been picked up by ABC and USA Today and Politico and MSNBC and a number of other networks. I'm guessing I don't think I've heard anything about it on Fox. Isn't that a surprise? But in any case, we do have this this time of the year, this time of the election season, to talk about. I was just a few minutes ago I was watching a replay of a Daily Show from last week, and Michael Steele was the guest, and you referred to it as a multi-day infomercial, I believe was the phrase that he used. But nevertheless, a lot of very interesting and very important things come out of the convention, not the least of which, of course, is the platforms. And I think this election cycle, more than any, we have some very dramatic differences between the platforms. And a lot of the differences in the platforms have to do with, I think, our primary subject tonight, which is inclusivity and the fact that the GOP is perceived as, in some ways rightly so, as phenomenally less inclusive than the Democratic Party. And so we're going to talk with a few guests that Eric has lined up. But before we do that, why don't we just sort of get a report, if you will, from our man in the street or our man on the floor, Eric. Eric, are you with us?
I'm here, Michael. How do I sound? Is it I'm hiding in the stairwell of the arena.
But I understand Michelle Obama is speaking right now, so I obviously can't be watching that while I'm on the radio. But so you're missing that speech?
Well, I think she might be being introduced. I don't hear her voice right now.
Well, you're coming through pretty well. So
cool.
Give us what has today been like building up to the opening of the convention?
Well, you know, I actually don't have the best seat in the House, actually, because my role is to document the caucus meetings, and so I'm either filming one or editing one, and I haven't had time to do much else. I filmed the Hispanic caucus, I filmed the Women's caucus, and I filmed the LGBT caucus, and I've been editing those two. The Hispanic caucus is done, and you can see it at the, it's in the description of this show, and I've been working on the LGBT all day, and Annabelle Park, who filmed the Women's caucus with me, is working with another editor on the Women's caucus video. So I don't know. I mean, I did want to kind of see the big arena. I like to go to Major League Baseball games, see the players that I'm used to seeing on TV in real life. This is kind of like that. Norm Mineta just walked past me. He's a hero in the Asian American community, former member of the Clinton cabinet, I believe. No, Bush cabinet. Sorry, the Bush cabinet. You know, a lot of the journalists I've seen, Chris Saliza Dana Milbank and those kinds of people walking around. But mostly I've been doing what I always do, filming stuff and editing stuff. The biggest reward has just been the people I've got to talk to, usually with a lens in between us, and you'll meet some of them today on the show.
Great. It's interesting. It sort of speaks to our topic tonight. The various caucuses that you've been part of have all been what we would call, you know, areas of inclusion that the Democratic Party has gone out of its way to include. I find myself stumbling over my own words, but certainly there's a lot in the platform that speaks to the rights of various groups, much more so. I think the equivalency in the Republican platform is just a few paragraphs. Is your feeling? I know. Last week, there have been running jokes, of course, that there were, you know, it was an incredibly white audience down in Tampa. What is the feel there that you've seen on that? Does it feel much more inclusive?
Well, sure, and I actually didn't see much of the Republican convention because I was running around so much. The only thing I actually sat down and watched on my iPhone was the Clint Eastwood speech. I heard Paul Ryan on the radio, and I actually haven't seen Mitt Romney's speech yet, which is probably the worst thing about the Eastwood thing, is that people who aren't necessarily political junkies, if they're going to find the time to watch one thing, they'll probably watch Clint Eastwood. But yes, it is incredibly diverse. It's, you know, it's the kind of places that I'm used to being. Hawaii, Los Angeles, Northern Virginia is becoming very diverse. And as a mixed race person, I definitely prefer that. There's never been a question for me as to whether I prefer the 21st century America that we're becoming or the America that we've been in the past. But I do sympathize and I understand why there is a constituency in America that does prefer the days of yore and prefers to be among people who share their race and their culture, their religion in many cases, or their sexual orientation. I mean, just as one example, when I went to college, I immediately sought out the Asian American students group, and within the Asian American students group, there was a mixed-race Asian American students group. And so, yes, one of the markers of the Republican Party is it's people who prefer to be among people who are white and Christian and heterosexual and conservative, and I think to each his own. But that's part of the choice that we have to make, I think, as a people. Do we embrace the 21st century and the America we're becoming or not?
I think you're absolutely right. There's been a lot of writing recently around the demographics in the country are changing in ways that favor the Democrats, given the current platforms and given the current attitudes. You know, that could be changed, obviously. I think it's the Republicans are in a position to decide what kind of party they want to be, particularly, I think, if they lose the election, which, although I don't want them to, I think they still are likely to, for the most part. I looked up a couple of interesting numbers today, as I often do before the show, just so I can sound more intelligent than I actually am. And going back to 1988, the voting populace was 15% minority. All minorities combined, 15% of the voting populace was minority. And that didn't change much between 88 and 2000, although obviously raw numbers because of population changed. In 2000, the number had risen from 15% to 19%. But in the last 8 years, rather, it's gone up 7 points all the way to 26%. So more than a quarter of the voting population now is minority. And, you know, I think we've seen pretty clearly the reaction to that in a lot of the legislature, legislative moves, for example, that have around voter rights and things of that nature. And clearly the GOP has a problem. There's question, the current direction of the GOP, the rise of the Tea Party, the ultra-conservatism, and frankly, I think some of the racism and homophobia that goes along with it does not bode well for the GOP in the future. So it remains to be seen. But by the way, with respect to, before I let you comment on that, with respect to the Romney speech, on my Scoop It page, the Middle Ground Scoop It page, I think it's scoop.it/t/coffee-party-conservatives, a couple of days ago I put up the text of Romney's speech. So if anyone is interested, you can go onto the Scoop It page and you can find it. I always find it more interesting to read the speeches. There was a bizarre an interesting study done 20, 25 years ago or so, perhaps even a little longer, with aphasics, people who had a particular kind of brain injury that prevented them from hearing emotional tone in voices. And so that whatever they heard was in a flat monotone. And they ran a series of tests on having them read political speeches and having them listen to political speeches and comparing, having them listen to political speeches and comparing that to people without the injury who could hear normally, hear all intonations normally. And the reactions to the speeches were very, very different. So after reading that study, I think some psychology textbook that I was reading for fun a while back, I decided that I would always read speeches before I heard them as a way to try to understand them. It's an interesting
thing. Interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The reactions were very, very different. We have a guest who's joined us and is waiting, and I think it might be a good idea to go ahead because he too may want to rush down and listen to Michelle Obama. So I don't want to keep him hanging too long. Actually, I think we just lost him. He must have lost his signal. That was Kevin Hoffman. So hopefully, Kevin, if you're still listening, you'll call back in a moment. And we'll have you in a minute. We also have somebody from area code 503, which I'm guessing is Janine, but why don't we go ahead and see.
It may not be Janine, actually.
It may not be?
No, it may be our guest because he lives from Oregon. So
let's
find out.
So I'm going to go ahead and bring in our caller from 503, and we'll find our mystery guest, I guess, tonight. One of the things about Blog Talk Radio is you can only identify by area code. But let's go see who it is. Calling in from area code 503. Hello, how are you? Are you our mystery guest this evening?
Hi, I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. And who is this?
This is Raphael.
Oh, Raphael, you are absolutely right, Eric. It is one of our guests. Raphael, welcome to the show. Raphael, you are you know what? Why don't I let you introduce yourself? Tell us what your role is at the convention.
I'm a Hispanic young delegate from Oregon, so just here to renominate President Obama and Vice President Biden.
So how did you are you a member of the Hispanic Caucus or?
Yes, I am.
You are. So tell me a little bit, I'm curious about the way, the role of a caucus at the convention. I mean, it's obviously more organized than just a group of people who claim commonality. Otherwise, the DNC wouldn't have Eric down there filming them. So what is the role of the caucus? Tell us a little bit about that.
We have two caucus meetings throughout the week. An impression I've gotten is just an opportunity for people who are part of the caucus to come together, have discussions about the issues facing the Hispanic population, and to listen to the Obama campaign and to the Democratic National Committee, talk about the issues that they're facing and how they're planning on winning the Hispanic vote this November.
So let's take that last point. What is the strategy for winning the Hispanic vote?
I think it's showing a clear contrast between President Obama and Governor Romney. It's someone who understands that immigrants are a vital fabric of our society, that they're here and that they are really important, and that we need to make sure to provide them with the access to move up to the middle class, to live the American dream. And that's the President Obama vision. I think the Romney vision is immigrants are not something that we care about, especially Hispanic immigrants. Especially when you consider the language self-deportation. making life so miserable that people will leave this country voluntarily. I think that's a pretty clear contrast. Also, when we talk about education for immigrants, especially for my family, you know, the way we achieve the American dream is by accessing education and a college education. President Obama's done a great job of increasing access to education through the Pell Grant. At the extension already, we talked, we listened to a couple of students talk about how the only reason they're in college is because President Obama's Pell Grant increases. That contrasts with the Romney plan, which would cut millions of students from Pell Grants and deny access to education to those who most need it.
So is there a general feeling that the let me ask the question a little differently. Let me start with a statement. As I often do, by the way, Raphael, I don't know if Eric warned you. I can go on and on quite a bit. It was clear in through the Republican primaries that the GOP, or at least it was clear to me, and I'm a moderate Republican, just to kind of put that on the table, that there isn't a single unifying view on immigration in the GOP. So even somebody who strikes me as someone I would never, even as a Republican, have managed to vote for, Newt Gingrich, was very, very moderate in his views, particularly with, you know, the importance of keeping families together, the importance of, you know, providing, you know, tracks to, you know, having worker programs, for example, and not sort of the conventional wisdom of the Republican platform being, you know, immigration is bad per se. Is there a general belief that the Republicans are sort of unified in anti-immigration, or is there any conversation around how compromise might be reached, or whether there are moderate Republicans who might want to have a more reasonable conversation?
I would love for there to be a conversation with the Republican Party that would lead to immigration reform. And you're right that there was differing opinions during the primaries. But at the end of the day, Mitt Romney won the nomination. His views and his platform are now what the party is fighting for. He is the presidential nominee for the Republicans. And he's the candidate who talks about self-deportation. He talks about cutting education funding. He talks a very harsh stance against immigration. At least he does these days.
Well, that's an interesting point, right? You say he does these days. You know, I'm of the belief that he is still more moderate than he's been forced to portray himself in order to get the nomination. And we could argue whether or not that's a character flaw. And actually, I don't think we'd argue that that's a character flaw. I think it is a character flaw. You'd probably agree with me. But there, you know, what's in the platform, and the Governor Romney who. You know, what a Governor Romney or what a President Romney might do. I'm not convinced that they're necessarily the same thing. And let's not forget, he's not going to have a supermajority in the Senate anyway, right? So he's not going to be able to put through anything like what the platform looks like. So to what degree might the platform just be, you know, sugarcoating to get the base out to vote? And that might be true in both parties, by the way, to some degree.
Well, I think, yeah, he might not get the supermajority in the Senate. So he couldn't pass the immigration bill, but I'm sure would be very anti-immigrant. You also have to realize that the Obama administration has been a leader in making sure that immigrants are being treated fairly through Department of Justice lawsuits. You have to realize that if you're the president, you can veto and block immigration reform. It's not just the power to sign legislation to law. It's the power to prevent legislation, and it's the power to send a strong message to the state.
No, I agree with you, and there's certainly a very strong argument for, you know, for example, the you know, Arizona having overstepped its states' rights, and even though I'm a strong believer in states' rights, I don't think there's any argument. You won't get an argument from me that immigration is a federal question, not a state's question. You know, if we slip away a little bit from immigration, and let's, you know, maybe go to the heart of it, is the general feeling that this is largely an issue of racism between the GOP and the Democratic Party? Is there a general feeling there that the GOP just wants to be white? That's kind of a hard question, but...
I like to see the best in people. I think that's part of the Democratic tenet of always looking to see the best of people. So I'm never going to accuse anyone of being a racist. And I just think that the Republican Party has a very different view of how they treat immigration. We also have to remember that immigration affects not only people of color, but also white people. You know, we have immigrants coming from Europe. We have white immigrants who come here, too, who have been majorly affected by what the Republican Party is proposing. But I think what the issue that really matters, it's not racism or who wants to be more white and who wants to be more brown, but rather the issue is who has the vision that's going to best enable us to move immigrants into the middle class, who has the vision that allows all Americans to access the middle class to affordable health care and quality education. I think that's the only issue that actually matters this election.
You know what? Very well said. And, you know, I think we all get trapped into a race narrative very easily. And I just did it myself. And forgetting that that the laws affect, you know, they may affect people of color in a greater percentage, but they affect everyone. I mean, if you talk about cutting education, that's cutting education. It's not cutting education for Hispanics or African Americans or Asian Americans. It's cutting education, period. And I think you make a very good point. Raphael, I want to thank you a ton for spending the time with me. I'm going to let you, you know, run on down and get a chance to hear Michelle Obama speak. And by the way, congratulations to you, you know, as a young man who's decided to become politically active and, you know, has worked their way through the system to become a delegate, you know, more power to you. There should be thousands and thousands of more like you to get involved. We'd all be better off.
All right, well, hey, thank you so much, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thanks, Raphael. Enjoy the convention. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
So, Eric, a striking young man. You picked an excellent. How did you come across Raphael, and what made you decide to bring on invite him onto the show?
You know, I just saw him sitting there, and he was in a row that I could get to because it was in front of the place where people can walk. And so I just walked up to him and asked him to do an interview. He looked so young that I thought that he was sitting between his parents, but they actually weren't his parents. And he told me in the interview, and not all of this made it in the final version of the video, but one of his parents is from Angola, and the other one is from, I think he said, Brazil. And it was another country in South America. He said that both of his parents grew up in countries that were under military dictatorship. And that when they came to America and they had a son, they really instilled in him the sense of civic duty based on the fact that in America you are free to become, you know, part of the Democratic Party as he has, and not fear for your life. And so he actually, from the age of 10, has been taking that as a sort of a responsibility that his parents put on him. And he sees it as a way of honoring his parents. And he said that his mom did everything she could to get out of work, and she's so jealous that she couldn't in order to travel with him to the convention. But they're deeply proud of him.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. For those of us, for those of you out there who were listening last week, Jessica English joined us. She's the host of The Bottom Line on Sundays at 5. And she had explained to us the process of becoming a delegate, and it's really a process that starts in your, you know, just at the very local level. And it's very easy to get involved. Kind of all you have to do is kind of show up and participate. And, you know, to have somebody like Raphael make that decision at his age to do that is a wonderful thing. You know, whichever side of the fence one comes down on, whatever beliefs one has, involvement is always a good thing.
I appreciated, yeah, Raphael's tone as well, and I find that it's rather common among young people. You know, they grow up in such a diverse America. I mean, it is the America for them. You know, they really don't have a choice about 21st century. They're born in the 21st century, and it's all they know. And so young people, actually, regardless of race, are less likely to be sort of mesmerized by the partisan political theater that we see on television or hear on the radio. And so, yeah, if you ask somebody under 30 about immigration, it's not going to be reduced to race. And he's absolutely right. A good policy, a sound immigration policy that allows our labor supply to meet the demands of a growing economy and improves our ratio of workers to retirees, which is only getting worse as the baby boomers retire, that would help all Americans to have a robust economy and to not have these deficits that result from having just too many people on the retirement rolls and not enough people working and building up the economy. And by the same token, you mentioned Arizona, a policy that redirects the resources of law enforcement away from public safety and toward immigration status checks makes communities less safe. All the statistics bear that out, not only in Arizona, but also in Prince William County, Virginia, where it all, I guess you could say, began. And I saw it firsthand and documented that. But not only does it hurt public safety, which affects everyone, it's also really bad for the economy when you create a jurisdiction, whether it's a county or a state, that has a reputation for political instability and for intolerance. Investors are less likely to come to your state to start new companies. And in fact, in Arizona, many companies left. And in Prince William County, on the smaller scale, we saw small business owners and homeowners decide to leave because they just either didn't feel welcome, they didn't feel safe, or they just didn't want to stomach the kind of racial division that this kind of political maneuvering causes. And they weren't necessarily tied, especially when their houses got underwater. And they owed more than the houses were worth. A lot of people just left, and Prince William County ended up with the worst home foreclosure rate on the Atlantic seaboard by a factor of 5.
Wow.
So that does affect everybody, not just people of color. As Annabelle says in the bonus feature director's commentary, when politicians use fear to win elections or to generate excitement in their base, the problem is that fear spreads. You can't contain it just to the people that you want to make afraid or to make feel unwelcome. Fear bounces back and spreads, and then it turns into other things that are even worse. And so I think that we need to encourage our politicians on whatever political aisle they come from not to use fear politics. Arizona, Prince William County, some of the most recent examples, but I think we have a history not only in this country but around the world of fear politics hurting everyone involved, even those who stood quietly by and didn't get involved.
On top of that, fear politics tends to lead to tribalism, right? You sort of gather with the people that you feel safest with. You and I have talked in the past that the demographic shift, I mentioned it at the top of the show, the demographic shift in the United States is certainly threatening to the power structures, which are still in this country largely white power structures. And all the moves that have been made have been, I think at this point, are proving counterproductive to the GOP. They're taking a tremendous amount of flack for this lack of inclusion. I wanted to play a little clip about that. John Huntsman was, he did an interview with, I think he was on, I have it written down here, the Your Money Show on CNN with Ali Velshi. And John Huntsman, for those of you who don't remember the 20 minutes that he was in the race back in late last year and into the New Hampshire primary, is a conservative Republican in the traditional sense, in that he is, he's pro Second Amendment, he's pro life, he's pro economic growth, he's pro tax relief, but he's also very moderate in a lot of ways. For one thing, it sounds odd to say you need to be a moderate in order to believe in science, but fundamentally that's part of where the party, the GOP, has gotten to. And Huntsman is pretty much persona non grata. He was not invited to the convention where all of the other primary candidates were, if they didn't have a role, at least were invited to the convention. Huntsman was actually invited to be an auxiliary and to be stationed in New Orleans, which as it turned out, because of the storm, would have been a double whammy. So he just declined altogether. But he had some interesting things to say about inclusion. I just want to play that quickly, and then we'll bring on our next guest and continue the conversation.
Increasingly, when you have a party that lacks inclusiveness, that is not focused on real solutions and delivering the bread and butter, bottom line issues that the American people are looking for, that lacks the sense of optimism and the big picture strategic thinking about America's role in the world, all of that is so desperately needed today.
He's absolutely right. He goes on, by the way, in that clip to talk about what you just mentioned, Eric, which is fear politics and the danger of fear politics and the ways in which it motivates people emotionally. If anyone is interested in hearing the whole clip is about a minute and a half. I just played about 25 seconds of it. You can certainly find it on CNN if you just go onto that site and look and search for Huntsman or look on the Your Money site. But here's a guy who ironically is arguing inclusion and is being left out, and it's sort of a sad state. I live in New Hampshire, so Huntsman was actually important to me for the 20 minutes of his relevancy. I got to meet him at a house party. We still have those in New Hampshire, and got to hear him speak on a couple of other occasions as well. And it was pretty clear from the very beginning that if he even doing reasonably well in New Hampshire, that he was just not going to have much of a chance, because he wanted to be inclusive and he wanted to consider all sides of complex questions, and the GOP just doesn't seem to be in that place right now. I want to go ahead and bring in our next guest, Eric, if that's all right with you.
Sounds great.
All right, so we're going to go to area code 713, which I believe is our friend who we lost earlier.
Yes.
Sir, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Kevin, okay. Kevin and...
I lost connections a couple times with you. So hopefully we don't drop it.
And it is a little bit difficult to hear you, Kevin. So, as close as you can get to your handset, Kevin is on a cell phone, obviously. They didn't provide us with a hold with landlines to do the show in Charlotte. As much as we lobbied them for it, they just somehow weren't interested. So that's not true. Obviously, we didn't lobby them for it. But everybody's on a cell phone tonight, so we will have... we may have some difficulty with the communications, but so Kevin, you are with the LGBT caucus, I understand.
Yes.
Kevin. Well, I think we're having some difficulty with Kevin, so I'm gonna hope that we can maybe he can find a place where he gets a little bit stronger signal. In the meantime, Eric, I'm gonna go ahead and talk to our next caller from area code 770. I don't know if we've got somebody calling in from the convention or this is a caller. By the way, I should mention before I bring on that caller, anybody listening who would like to call in and talk with Eric or myself or any of the if you have questions for any of the convention participants that we're bringing on as guests, please do call in and join us. Our phone number is 646-929-2495. That's 646-929-2495. And if you'd like to speak with us, just press 1 after you dial in, and that'll put you in the host queue, and I'll bring you in as the order allows. Let's go ahead and bring in our guest from area code 770. 770, welcome to the Middle Ground.
Hey, thanks. This is Patrick, and I am at the convention.
Hello, Patrick.
Yeah.
And what's your role at the convention?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is, as you guys are looking at the convention, you'll see, if those who will be watching it, you'll see every once in a while people with Robin Hood hats on. There's a lot of them.
Really? That's it. I haven't had a chance to look, obviously. I've got it DVRing, so I'll go down and pay attention to that after the show. And the Robin Hoods, for those of us listening who don't know, signify what?
Yeah, so that's a plan. It's a plan for a bill. It's actually the kind of thing you're hearing is already happening in Europe, where there's a Robin Hood tax, they're calling it, which is for plan for these Wall Street traders who do nothing for the economy. They just make money off of trading all day. They don't really build anything. They don't really make anything here in the country. They don't. They're just making money for themselves. So your hedge fund people, your people that are messing with, slicing and dicing mortgages, that kind of thing. This would put a tax on those types of transactions. And the goal is to do two things. One is to lower the number of transactions that do that, because some people will say, hey, that's starting to add up. Or maybe I shouldn't do that, because a lot of people are just trading, you know, and they're making money. Whether people win or lose, this would become pretty evident pretty quickly. It's a sizable amount of money that they think they can raise.
But what would sizable be?
Probably in the $300 to $400 billion range.
Annually?
In a year, yes.
Yeah.
That's
sizable.
The trading is tremendous. It's furious. It's fast. It's these, you know, they're using the computers to do a lot of this stuff. This is an international effort, and it started in the UK, and it started with the National Union of Nurses, which is an international union. People who were saying, hey, you know, why can't we get more money towards education or towards healthcare or other things? Why are you holding that hostage when there is money out there, but people who just work with their money are not really contributing? And so it's not for the guys sitting at home or the girls sitting at home who just, you know, working with stock trades and that kind of thing and just in your own world. This is for the heavy-duty trader that really is doing tons of transactions, good or bad, for any country, and never being taxed on that. So
let me ask a couple questions, and just, you know, fair disclosure, I spent several years working for Thomson Reuters, and so I know a little bit about this, not a ton, but I know a little bit about this. Is it really the amount of money and the number of trades, or is it simply the kinds of instruments that are being created that allow for the kinds of risk that are involved? So, for example, I'll give you an example. Reuters is the worldwide leader in Thomson Reuters is the worldwide leader in foreign exchange transactions, and they're not as well known here, where, you know, Bloomberg does a lot of has a lot of the trading platforms, but in Europe it's pretty much all Reuters, particularly in foreign exchange. Foreign exchange is not fundamentally subject to the same kind of manipulation relative to derivatives and instruments that things like mortgages are. So is it really the trades themselves and the money that's floating around, or is it the type of instruments that causes the problem?
Yeah, it is somewhat the types of instruments, because a lot of this is, as you say, because you know something about it, it's the derivatives and it's the currency exchange. A lot of stuff done with currencies today, millisecond type stuff. That's
much faster than that.
Yeah, exactly. It's detrimental to you.
I can tell you that.
Milliseconds. So it has kind of a two pronged effect. One is to cut down on and kind of stabilize the market a bit from these crazy transactions, and secondly, to collect some money from, you know, somebody who makes money on all of us, but doesn't really contribute to that. So, like I said, it started in England. Some of the other countries are picking it up now. It's an international thing, and I believe the person who's going to lead it, I just heard him talk today, is going to be Representative Ellison out of Minnesota. He's going to be one of the lead proponents of this. I think his name's all over the proposal. So it's something that's in its infancy, but it's, you know, it is something that I think you'll see some activity, and that's why you're seeing, you will see, when you take a look at this thing, you'll see Robin Hood hats everywhere. It's got a simple name on it, Robin Hood hats.
I'm interested in the ideological question. I've heard this before, that somehow the idea of making money without producing something is inherently bad. So if I'm sitting at home, and through regulation, and I'm not anti-regulation at all. I'm for intelligent regulation, if the regulations are in place, and they're not, but if they were in place that would protect people when they were signing mortgages, that would have reduced the risk of subprime, and by the way, let's not forget that Clinton was a proponent of some of this as well, not just over the last, during the 2000-2008 period. Why does it matter to me, or why would it matter to you, as long as I'm okay, if somebody sitting in New York or London or Vancouver is or Hong Kong is making money trading with people who want to trade? What's wrong with that? Why does there have to be a productive output? Why is it not just okay for people to make money?
Yeah, that's what somebody would say from Wall Street, who would say...
Well, I'm not from Wall Street. I was in a software development group.
I'm not saying that you were. What I'm saying is, I'm taking a devil's advocate approach. That's
right.
What the devil's advocate would say. What's the big deal? I'm just making money. You know, I have a right to make money. Well, the problem is because it affects all of us. Wall Street has not been good to Main Street.
Agreed.
Wall Street has made tremendous bets on our money. You know, if you look back at the TARP season, the pre-TARP, you know, we lost 20% of our national value in about 18 months of wealth in the United States that took 200 years to build up or more.
No question. A lot of people were hurt. Pension plans, 401k plans. I mean, people are just now getting back to even.
So what this is aiming at doing is, it's okay to make, hey, you want to make money on the stock market, that's great. But when it crosses the line, when you start to hurt the economy and I'm all of us bailed out Wall Street, every single taxpayer. So you're not just trading on your own. So you do have vehicles like the derivatives and the these tremendous numbers of trades on currency and that kind of thing, which are not, they not only not help the American taxpayer, they end up hurting the taxpayer.
Interesting. I want to bring Eric back into this conversation. I'd be curious to get his perspective on this. Eric, welcome back. We lost you for a little bit, but you're back now, right?
Yes, I am. I actually hung up on purpose just to remind Erica, another person that I invited to come on the show to call in. My sense is that when you have a wealth extraction, a wealth redistribution from the middle class to the oligarchical class, there are a couple of problems with that. One of them is that when the middle class doesn't have the purchasing power to put their kids through school without borrowing, or buy a new car without borrowing, to buy a home, to buy groceries, then what happens is that you have to give them credit, right? You have to find a way to give them easy credit, make their homes value inflated, or give them credit cards, and basically market them into living the life that they were living before this wealth extraction. And so that's, I think, what was happening in the 2000s. We were instructed to go shopping, and we did, but a lot of us didn't really actually have that money to pay those bills. So that was one problem. It creates bubbles. But the other problem, you know, it creates bubbles if we're going to continue to have a growing economy. You know, as Krugman said at the beginning of the bubble economy, it's better to have a bubble growth, growing on a bubble than an economy that's collapsing. But that's the choice we're left with when you extract the wealth from the middle class to the ruling class. And then the other problem is that they become too powerful politically when they have all of the wealth in the country. And you see both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. This convention is funded by large banks and large corporations. The campaigns and the super PACs and the commercials are funded by those corporations. And so it puts the people at a deficit, not only financially, but also in terms of our democracy and having a say, especially with the Citizens United decision, basically putting a premium on money as the most important kind of currency in our democracy, not our votes. So I think that we do have to make an adjustment here, and I think our Constitution gives us the tools to do so. It's just we have to have the civic courage.
Well, certainly the power to tax is there. It's two things strike me, and Patrick, you know, you're welcome to chime in on this in a moment, and then I want to go ahead and bring in our next caller as well. The first is that I agree with your points about essentially, you know, you're talking about the wealth gap essentially, and this is one of the mechanisms that has created the wealth gap in your argument. One of the things that I think of is why simply not create intelligent tax policy around personal and business income tax? Why do we need to create a new kind of transaction tax? Why is that the mechanism that's needed? And correlatively to that, why would those transactions simply not go elsewhere? And yes, Wall Street is a big piece, right? But I could arguably see the minimization of the United States and Wall Street, physically Wall Street in particular, as a major economic and financial player, and other parts of the world, you know, London and Bangkok and Hong Kong, and I mentioned some of these other places, the Philippines, and South Korea, that are fast becoming major exchanges themselves and major financial centers themselves. Wouldn't we just potentially be forcing some of that money out of the country?
Okay. Again, you're hearing part of what I'm saying, but not picking up on a couple points.
Okay. No, please clarify.
Number one, this is an international effort. We're behind other countries on this. So other trading markets are putting this in place because they've had an issue with this.
Well, you mentioned Europe, right? So Europe essentially would mean, in any meaningful terms, would mean Germany and England.
Right. Well, it's going to be Europe and Asia will probably do this before we do. So it's not like you're going to be able to go to – we're not going to shift this to another exchange. Other exchanges are going to try to have this in place before us.
Okay. Well, I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, that would make a difference, yes.
Keep in mind, it's an international effort. It's not just a U.S. effort because other countries have exactly the same problem. Look what's going on in Europe right now. Some of that's gone on in Asia as well. And look what we just went through with the whole LIBOR thing.
Mm-hmm.
We just slapped these guys, you know, to some extent, and when we gave them a little bit of rein to say, okay, let's go, they went right back to misbehaving because they're in so much control, so much money, so much of the interest rate, and that's where it hurts the average taxpayer. Is that they can do what they want to. There's no penalties. No one's gone to jail. Have you seen anyone go to jail over any of this?
No. I completely agree with you on those points. Yeah.
No one's got a penalty. So I would see this as a not adding a whole lot of tax code. It's really adding a tax for the people instead of a tax on the people. So it's not taxing the average Joe who wants to go out there and trade and that kind of thing. It's taxing those professionals who are in the business making gazillion trades a day. In fact, they're probably not making the trades. Their computer's making those trades.
No, definitely. It's all it's algorithmic, definitely.
Yeah, you're the software guy.
It's machines.
Exactly. So think of it that way.
Yeah, people can't move anywhere near fast enough in this day and age. I mean, there obviously are individual people making – there are a lot of people making individual trades, but the vast majority of trades these days – are a combination of a piece of financial data and a piece of news that's been textually analyzed, combining in something like 30 or 40 milliseconds and triggering off an algorithmic trading sequence. That's what's happening. It's not people.
Right.
I mean, people are designing the strategies, no question. But
hey, Michael, I wanted to add one thing.
Yes.
When I go to the ATM machine, there's actually a pretty hefty tax on me. It doesn't go toward roads and bridges and education or defending our country. It goes toward the profits of the bankers. But, $3 will come out of my personal bank account if I withdraw from the wrong bank. And that actually has a sort of a retarding effect on how quickly I take the money out or when I do. The same is true, actually, potentially if I do it more than six times a month can be charged for moving money from my savings account to my checking account.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do it six times a month and no more because I don't want to give $3 to the bank. So I have a feeling that this Robinhood tax would actually put the brakes on all this, just the incredible speculation and casino gambling and just all of this. I mean, that's mind-boggling that it's computers that are just worrying around money, you know, imaginary dollars and cents to the billions of dollars, and basically, you know, putting our economy at risk in order to enrich just a very, you know, small number of people. Maybe they'd change the algorithm a little bit, and it wouldn't be as risky if we had this brake system on.
Yeah, I think when you hear the numbers, it's really phenomenal. So, for example, in the foreign exchange market, every day the amount of currency traded is three times the total amount of money in the world. Basically, every single, you know, centavo, peso, dollar, euro is traded three times every day. It's phenomenal. I mean, you're talking about enormous amounts of flow. And that's just foreign exchange. So anyway, Patrick, I want to thank you for calling in. We've got a couple of other conventioneers who are going to join the show for a little while. But thank you for bringing that up. That wasn't on our topic list. I'm going to go look for those, I'm assuming, green felt hats on a number of delegates down there on the floor. Thanks very much for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
That was definitely interesting, Eric. The whole, I kind of wonder. I think your example is an interesting one. I'm always, as a conservative, particularly a fiscal conservative, my strategy is always, you know, ready, aim again, am I ready to fire? No, I better aim again. Okay, fire. And I look at a situation like this, and I think about the example that you just gave, and what I imagine is that your ATM fee and my ATM fee goes up to $5, right, instead of $3, and your transaction limit goes down from $6 a month to $2.
They just shift the cost down.
Because they'll shift the cost, right? So again, I kind of wonder whether or not, I kind of look at more. I've always kind of felt the dollar is a dollar is a dollar, and basically you tax income, and you tax income when companies make it, and you figure out how, you know, they don't write off everything in their mother. You know, every piece of IKEA furniture gets depreciated at five times its original cost, whatever it happens to be, and you tax people, right? And you try to do that as fairly as you can. I'm not talking about a flat tax. I'm talking about a progressive tax, but a fair one. And you tax every dollar the same. So if you tax, you no longer give the breaks for the capital gains, for example. You no longer give breaks for mortgage deductions even. I've taken a lot of flack on that one. And I think that adding another specialized tax that targets a special interest group, and they are. I mean, you know, they're a special interest group that's on the plus side of the equation, but Wall Street is a special interest group of a kind. They're going to find a way to get that money back. And I think what we'll end up doing it is redistributing it from their right pocket to their left pocket, and it'll come through us just briefly enough to make us all feel like we've done something good. That's sort of the unintended consequence that I worry about when we go down these kinds of paths. And, you know, it's an interesting debate to have. There's a fair bit of justification for both arguments, I think.
Well, I'm just pleased that we're able to talk about it. It was something the Occupy movement was introducing just about the time that we decided that we had to send in the police with batons and helmets and armor to make sure that whole conversation stopped.
Yeah, I do remember the Robin Hood. There was a celebrity. Was it Russell Crowe? Or maybe I'm just thinking of the movie, but there was a celebrity involved. Well, no, he was in Robin Hood. I think I've got the two. I think I've just had a synapse misfire. I apologize to the entire listening audience and anybody who might ever listen to the archive. But I know there was a celebrity involved who was pushing this thing. And if you give me a minute, I'm going to ask you to take the lead on the next interview, and I'm going to figure this out. Let's bring in our next caller. This is, I believe, again, Kevin. We're going to try again with Kevin. Kevin, are you with us? Hopefully this time it will work.
Yes, I am.
Oh, and you sound really good. Nope, now you're breaking up again. All right, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Kevin, I think unfortunately it's very difficult to hear you. I'm afraid. I appreciate the fact that you've been running around trying to find a really good cell phone spot. I don't know where Eric is. His spot seems to work well. But let's give it a shot. And if it's difficult to hear you, then we'll have to move on to our next caller. So when you called before, you mentioned I asked you the question. You are in the LGBT caucus.
Correct.
Correct.
I am also a member of the Hispanic caucus.
Which caucus? I'm sorry.
The Hispanic caucus.
The Hispanic caucus as well.
I am
okay.
Not a Hispanic.
Okay, I think we're going to have to move on from Kevin. Unfortunately, we've tried. I did have a couple questions I wanted to run by him, but unfortunately we're just not being able to hold that cell phone signal. So, Kevin, I want to thank you for calling in. I did just want to quickly make one point that I was going to talk to Kevin about. The of course it's a very big deal, Eric. This is a presidency, an administration, and a platform that for the first time in history has embraced LGBT causes, particularly with respect to gay marriage. It was an incredibly, incredibly risky move. I wanted to, though, just to kind of, again, to remind people that the Republican Party is not a single cohesive unit, despite what the platform says. Neither is the Democratic Party a single cohesive unit, despite what the platform says. And so I looked up a couple of numbers, and there was a recent study done, Pew Research, I've got it here, and this was done in May. And they did some breakdowns on the demographics around those who favored and those who disfavored gay marriage. And by the way, this is separate from civil unions. So, for example, John Huntsman, the example I used before, is somebody who's come out and said he's in support of civil unions, not necessarily in support of gay marriage. In the Democratic Party, I'm going to quiz you, Eric, and we'll see what the conventional wisdom says if you happen to know the numbers. Can you tell me what you think the percentage of Democrats are that support gay marriage?
I would say 35.
So actually, it's 59.
Okay.
59%.
Cool.
So actually, I thought your number might be a little bit higher. What would you think it would be for the GOP?
Well, I only said low because otherwise it wouldn't have been interesting.
Oh, because they set you up for it, right?
Yeah.
We've done too many shows, I think, together.
But that would be cool. I mean, if the two of them were close together. So you said Democrat was in the 60s.
No, 59.
I wouldn't be surprised. 59. I mean, it would be cool. I'd love to be able to say that the Republicans are in the 40s.
No, actually 23.
Okay.
So it's still there's still a big gap. There's no question it's a big gap. And there's a little bit more of a breakdown. Women at 51% versus men at 42%. Baby boomers at 39%, Gen X at 51%, millennials at 63%. So you can see how that demographic shift plus is going to favor and has favored the subject in a long time. But my point here is that there's 40% of the Democratic Party sitting out there today that doesn't agree with that plank, right? It's still not a unified position, and it's still not a unified party, despite what the plank says. And in the GOP, for those who still occasionally want to call me a Republican, which I get every once in a while, I'm one of those 23%. Right? So just about a quarter of the party is in support of gay marriage. And of course, if you look at civil unions, the numbers on both sides are higher still. I think this is an inevitable wave. And I live in a state that has gay marriage, New Hampshire, which I'm proud of. But there are, there are people in both parties who have differing positions. And while the conventional wisdom, the stereotype, is true in terms of, you know, the GOP is certainly more against gay marriage than the Democratic Party is. There are people in both parties who support it and people in both parties who don't. And, you know, it's my hope that we can generate more people in the GOP and get those numbers up.
The same is true for immigration and many other issues. And I think that's one of the lessons that I learned by working on immigration and some other issues that really required bipartisan cooperation. And that is, if you use terms like re-thugulacons, you know, if basically you point to every mistake a Republican makes or every offensive thing a Republican person says and say, well, there you go, all Republicans are like that, well, then you're actually cutting yourself off from that opportunity to share ideas or share cause with people who belong to that community, because they now see you as someone who they just, you know, can't talk to. So, yeah, it's not, for me, the, you know, and I feel very strongly about equality for all people. And I've said that, you know, equality is meaningless to me if it excludes anyone. Otherwise, it's not equality. And I've seen three of the caucuses, and the one that was the most moving for me was the GLBT caucus, because they've made some big strides recently. There was a lot of energy in the room as a result. And it sort of echoed the Andrew Sullivan quote from his NPR interview, how meaningful it was for him. I think he said it took his breath away to hear his president acknowledge his humanity. And I really got that sense from a lot of people in the room today. I'm cutting a video together for tomorrow. I hope it captures some of that. I don't think it will quite do justice to that sentiment. But I do identify with the feeling of people rejecting who you are based on your birth, you know, based on how you were born,
mm-hmm.
You know, growing up in Virginia and being of mixed ancestry. Even relatives of mine, you know, made remarks about me being a half-breed or that they felt sorry for my dad, that I would be a half-breed when I was born. And so that is something that, you know, for whatever reason, I've always had a strong affinity with the gay community, even through the years, the 80s and the 90s, when it seemed like talking about a major political party actually embracing the community, not secretly in the back room saying, not yet, but we do support you, we just can't say it yet, but actually publicly saying, we embrace this community. We don't care if some of them look funny. We don't care if some of them are loud. We don't care if a lot of people are weirded out by them, or we don't care if the other party is going to try to organize around hatred. We are just going to stand on principle. And so while I don't think that we need to use the issue to beat up on people who identify as Republican, because as you said, there's diversity there, I think that we can use that issue to gauge the principles of the two parties and what might guide them as we try to govern this country that's becoming increasingly diverse and increasingly inclusive and not only tolerant but celebrant, you know, celebrating our diversity.
Yeah, you know, to tie that back to the point of the show, there's definitely an inclusivity issue, right? Because I am not fundamentally like a John Huntsman. Well, I'm not like a John Huntsman. I'm an incredibly minor public figure, but in the sense of having similar beliefs on some of these issues, you know, I too don't feel terribly welcome in my party, where I think in general people who disagree with the Democratic platform are still welcomed because there's some other level of common ground, whether it's around poverty or education or you know, whatever those other kinds of issues might be. It seems much more in the GOP that these, particularly these social issues, are a litmus test for whether or not you can come into the tent. And in that respect, the GOP, I think, has a long way to go in becoming much more inclusive. I think also on this particular issue, and I'm really sorry we weren't able to connect with Kevin because I wanted to get his take on this. I don't think anyone will. I don't in any way want to diminish the importance of what the Democratic Party has decided to do in putting that in their platform, nor the political risk that that Barack Obama, President Obama, has taken in being very, out front about this. This is still not a federal issue. This is a state's issue, right? There are I want to say six, maybe it's more now, that recognize gay marriage. Six states, if I've got that absolutely right, Iowa, New Hampshire, well, the District of Columbia, I believe, New York. I'm not sure what the others are offhand, but it's still a small handful. And what needs to be remembered is that of the 50 governorships in the country, 30 of them are held right now by Republicans. Of the total number of members of state legislatures in the country, there are approximately just a little over 2,900 elected state legislative members nationwide. 1,900 of them are Republican, and roughly a little over 900 of them are Democrats. And much of that has to do with the 2010 election, and it will be interesting to see what shifts, if anything, both in this election and in the midterm. But, I think those of us who agree with you, the 23% in my party and the 59% in the Democratic Party, who believe this is the right thing to do, can't for a moment assume that this platform and this president are necessarily going to change the minds of those legislatures, of those governors. And I'm not saying that all of them are against gay marriage. I mean, here in New Hampshire, we have a Republican legislature. But for the most part, those battles are still going to have to be fought at local ground up and state levels.
Really quickly, Michael, you know where else it matters, though? I talked to a woman who lives in North Carolina, African-American woman. Oh, actually, she might have been Latina, mixed. And she is a lesbian. She's married. They were married in Massachusetts, I believe. And recently, North Carolina passed an amendment that banned gay marriage. And she said the next day she woke up and she felt so deflated. Even though she expected it, she felt like her neighbors looked at her as a second-class citizen. And she described a certain pity, a certain compassion that a neighbor of hers had. This neighbor wanted to explain the marriage to her children. And had never really felt that she could try to explain it until it was actually, I believe, the day after this vote, President Obama said that he supports marriage equality and the right of all people to marry the person that they love and have the legal protections, to have equal protection under the law. And she said that my neighbor was then able to actually talk to her children about this issue because the president had actually said it, and it was something that she thought her child could understand more readily because of it. So these things matter in terms of policy, but they also matter in terms of the culture that we bring our children into and the culture that we leave for the next generation.
I totally get the point. I can't imagine the feeling. I mean, literally, I can't imagine it. I mean, I've said more than once, to paraphrase Pearl Jam, I won the lottery when I was born. I'm a white male American, and so it's very hard for me to really conceive of what that must feel like. I think my point is that either 5 months from now, or 4 years and 5 months from now, it will be an ex-president who said it. And if the work doesn't continue, or if anyone rests on their laurels on this issue because it's in the platform or because Barack Obama stood up and was brave enough to say what he said, the job's not going to get done. In any case, we do have one more caller. I believe we've had somebody come in and go out from area code 513. It might be another conventioneer. Let me bring this person into the conversation. Area code 513, welcome to the middle ground.
No, I didn't go out. This is Laura. Who is this?
This is Michael. Michael Charney and Eric Beiler. Hi, Laura. Where are you calling from? Oh.
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, yes, of course. Laura from Cincinnati. You called in before. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you for your patience. We wanted to speak with as many of the people who were actually at the convention as we possibly could, and take advantage of, sort of sound like a real radio station with reporters on the street and everything. What would you like to chat about?
I just want to basically say one thing. When people are doing better, that's great. We're happy for you. But please don't forget, some of us aren't. A lot of us aren't. When you say that, I mean, it's not a good logo to help reelect Obama. Well, I'm doing better, the rest of us who aren't are going to say, well, whoopee for you. Let's not live in the bubble.
Well, no, I agree with you, and I haven't watched any of the convention yet, but I plan on barreling through it over the next few days. I think you will hear. I predict that you will hear a fair bit of conversation about times still being tough. But as you know, again, to as I mentioned earlier, Michael Steele's phrase, that this is essentially an infomercial, and it's meant to do as much as possible to motivate people to come out and vote, to get to get that convention bump, as it were. I don't think you're going to hear a lot of conversation about the things that aren't working well. I just don't expect that you'll hear it. I don't think that means that it's been forgotten.
It isn't talked about anymore. I don't know what happened to all those people who lost their homes and were living in their cars, because nobody gives them a sniff anymore.
Well, you have a fair point there. We have a we are a nation that enjoys its news at the moment, and one could argue that the Great Recession carried with it some of the longest news cycles that we've ever seen on things like mortgage issues and unemployment. But I would agree with you. I don't know how you feel about it. This is just impression. I certainly haven't done any counts. But I would agree that there's less talk, I think, about some of the pain. Do you think that's true? Do you think we've grown tired of the stories, or do you think it's part of the election cycle? Eric, we're losing. I think Eric has moved to maybe his hallway is losing its signal.
Sorry, I'll go to my hallway.
Okay, back to your hallway, Eric. We keep Eric in a closet during the show.
I was just disappointed because someone in the coffee party put that on Facebook. Are you doing better than I am? I'm like, that's not a good way to unite people.
Well, there's a certain argument for optimism, as a way of uniting people as well. I the people that I know in the coffee party, I know all of the people who, including myself, who have the rights to administer the page. We none of us have forgotten that things have gotten tough, and there are, I think, pretty regularly reminders in the kinds of things that we scoop or the kinds of things that we put on our Facebook pages about that. And we try to be pretty good at challenging some of the conventional wisdom, but I don't think you'll find anyone who works those pages at the coffee party who would disagree with you on the fact that I just wrote a blog on Sunday, a Labor Day blog, talking about sort of what we've built, both good and bad, and earlier last week I wrote something that talked about the fact that there are still more than 12 million people unemployed, and a lot of people underwater on their mortgages, and we're a long way from celebrating. So if there was a post here or a post there, that may be true, but I don't think I agree that the coffee party in general is forgetting that there's still a lot of pain out there. Eric, are you with us now? You're back in your hallway?
Yeah, I can. I can hear you. I'm back in the hallway. There's another person who absconded. I think he's a member of the press to the quiet. This the, where you leave the arena stairway.
Your signal's great now. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, Laura, thank you for bringing that up. I mean, one of the great things about the Coffee Party Facebook page, for those of you who don't know it, it's facebook.com/coffeeparty, is that each time we post something, we do get feedback, and we do read those comments. We go and we look and see if things are, if it's being well-received. We look and see if there are comments that get caught up in our spam filter, because we put all the dirty words and all the hyper-partisan words in our spam filter, and then sometimes people might use them in a different context, and then we free up the comments. So, we spend a lot of time reading those comments, and it's valuable to hear input. And, we should never forget that, the people who are struggling the most are the ones that we are all those are the ones that we're all motivated to try to help, and that's the reason why we care so much, because we know there's that much suffering out there. And just in our defense, I would say that you know, with Jessica English, you know, having experienced her ex-husband's job loss and her family suddenly plunging into poverty and having to go to things like the food shelf and to go on public assistance. Really, only now that we've hired her as the membership and volunteer coordinator for the Coffee Party, only now is she escaping that that economic situation. But she is a fierce advocate for the poor, and she educates me and I think Michael all the time about that experience. And I'm very proud. I think it's one of the proudest accomplishments of the Coffee parties that we've given a national voice to someone who can speak with authenticity from the perspective of being in poverty.
No question. And even you know, to a person, Laura, in for those of us who do the radio shows and work on the Facebook pages, we have differing degrees of how we define a social safety net. And so I think, for example, you know, certainly Jessica's definition and even further left than that, Egberto, if you've ever listened to his show, would be very different from mine. But we all do agree that there is a basic level of support that's needed to eliminate what Jessica refers to. I love the term. She refers to them as the insecurities, right? And they have to do with, you know, things like a living wage and enough to feed your family and redefinition of what poverty even means. I mean, if you took...
hear that definition.
You want to hear that definition?
Yeah, so, I want to hear the definition of poverty.
So, well, all right, it's a statistical one, right? In the U.S., it's some number. I think I looked it up recently, and for a single person, it was something absurdly low, like...
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's absurdly low, right? So I did, at the request of somebody on my own blog, we did a comparison of Finland. I don't know why we chose Finland, but if we used Finland's definition of poverty, our poverty rate would be something like 32%. Even our definitions of poverty are ridiculous. So, but that's sort of a side note. The point is while I, as a moderate Republican, might argue on a different kind of social safety net than Jessica would, or Alberto, or even probably you, Eric, we all agree in the Coffee Party that these are serious problems, and there does need to be some way and some level, some floor around the basic insecurities of home and food and health care that need to be addressed so that people can get up in the morning and not worry about whether or not they can eat or whether or not they have to decide, as many senior citizens do, on whether or not they take their medicine or pay their rent.
Yeah, not to mention getting suicidal when they tell you, we're showing you the door.
Well, yes, it does. It does. It definitely does. So, you know, if we at any time have given you the impression that that's not a concern of the Coffee Party, please accept our apologies. You should know, and everybody should know, that it's one of the you know, our we talk about Wall Street reform and tax reform and you know, money in politics and those kinds of things as being our principal mission. But, you know, underlying it all is a belief from all of us that there is a need for these basic securities.
Well, you know, that does affect poverty, all that stuff.
Sure.
Right?
Oh, of course. Of course. Absolutely. Oh, it definitely does. Sure. There's no question about it. But, you know, the idea that that simply by taking care of those other bullet points will handle the poverty problem is not what we believe. We believe that those bullet points are fundamental to a growing and thriving, fair and equal democracy, a democratic republic. But we do not believe for a minute that those are the answer to all of our problems. And like I say, Eric pointed this out. Our Facebook posts. Sometimes we intentionally put stuff up there to drive interesting conversations, to shake people loose from some of their stereotypical thinking. And it may be that you stumbled across some of those. I know. You know, guilty as charged. I do that quite often to try to get people to think a little bit differently than sort of being on automatic pilot. But you and everyone listening should know that the Coffee Party absolutely believes in these one of our first principles, no question.
I want to say one other thing real quick. Mike, thank you. That was such a great conversation.
Well,
and
thank you.
Do people realize when Bill Clinton signed in welfare to work that we had more jobs and the economy was booming? People were driving around looking for drunks and bums to get to do the work because they were so desperate. Burger King was giving bonuses for signing up with them as an employee. That's not now. That was then.
I don't know how easily I'm not an economics expert, but I do know that the systemics that drive good times and bad times are much bigger than any one factor. And so I don't know to what degree welfare reform did or didn't have a role in that growth. It probably did have a role. It certainly was. It was a reform. I mean, positive or negative, whether you like it or didn't, it was definitely reform, and it certainly had an economic and systemic effect, but I don't know how big it might have been.
Now, you misunderstood me. I'm just saying everybody likes to talk about Bill Clinton, who was a Democrat, working with the Republicans doing that. But I'm saying, you know, back then there were jobs aplenty. There was money.
I see your point. So, yeah, right.
Yeah,
so
you can have a signing bonus just for going to Burger King and working for a few months.
Right.
Now,
so it was easier to do quote unquote welfare reform because it wasn't needed as much. That's your point.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair point. It's easier to get stuff through. There's definitely relationships between, you know, the kind of the big issues at any given election cycle and what's going on in the economy fundamentally. I mean, we can go back to, things like, Eric, you and I were talking earlier about immigration, and you and I have talked in the past, there's at least a reasonable correlation between the angst around immigration issues and the state of the economy. It tends to become an issue when the economy is having tougher times. So I think your point's well taken. We're almost getting ready to wind up, Laura. So I'm going to go ahead and thank you for the call again, and please, you know, you call in frequently. It's always a joy to talk to you. And I think Erica, you and I from the convention floor, and me from my comfortable den in New Hampshire, will wind up the show in just a few minutes. Thanks, Laura.
You're welcome.
So Eric, we've got about 5 minutes left. What is on the agenda for you over the next couple of days? I'm sure you're going to be Facebook posting and you're going to be sending some videos. And what can we expect to see? What can the Coffee Party expect to see from the convention over the next few days?
Well, Annabelle Park, the founder of the Coffee Party, as many of you know, she's been traveling to Europe and to Asia. She's going back to Asia again in October, but she is actually here at the convention. When they asked me to do this volunteer documentary work, I said, hey, I know somebody else who can rent a camera. And so they brought Annabelle down as well. And I'm really hoping to get Annabelle to sit down and tell us about this new essay that she's writing. She's not happy with what the Democrats are saying. She's not happy with what the Republicans are saying. She always has a way of synthesizing two arguments, a thesis and an antithesis, into a synthesis argument. And so I'm going to try to force her to sit down and talk to me a little bit, and then I'll cut in some B-roll that I've shot and kind of give you a convention experience video. So that's one thing you can look for. And I will share everything I do for the convention. So far, they've had me do Hispanic Caucus, LGBT Caucus, and Women's Caucus. Actually, I just filmed that one, and Annabelle did the interviews and she's doing the editing with a young woman named Bonnie. And then tomorrow, I'm going to go to the Asian American Caucus, which will be nice. I'll probably see a lot of friends there. And so these little, 90-second, minute-long videos, kind of maybe have an Eric touch. And you'll see me share them on the Facebook page or maybe on the website or both.
Great. I'm definitely looking forward to it. And, as always, if you're sort of between one stairwell and another and you need anyone, myself included, to get some stuff up on the Facebook page or on the blog or somehow communicate it out, definitely give us a holler, and we'll make sure that your voice is heard. To that point, I want to invite anyone who's listening who is either at the convention or knows someone at the convention, please feel free to write up, a couple paragraphs of what you're doing. You can email them to me. I'm at, I'm not even sure what my, it's michael.charney@coffeepartyusa.com. And I will find a way to get that information out onto our Facebook page, or I will get it onto my blog or onto Scoop It and link through to it so that everybody can hear what's going on at the convention. I think, like I said at the top of the show, we have a unique opportunity. It's only once every 4 years, and, 4 years ago, in 2008, certainly people in the coffee party today were very active and involved, but this is the coffee party's first opportunity to be on a convention floor, and we'll look forward to more, but we want to take advantage of it as much as we can. So anybody who's out there who in any way wants to contribute to that conversation over the next few days, please email us and let us know, or you can also post anything you want onto our timeline on our Facebook page, and we'll review that on a regular basis and take a look for anything interesting that we can circulate out to everybody. So just on a last note, I wanted to remind everybody and ask everybody to take a minute, if you can, and visit our donation page at coffeepartyusa.com. Just click on the donate link in the top toolbar. Every grassroots dollar is important to us, I think particularly around this Labor Day. On the one hand, we know that it's tough for people, but it's a time when we can all sort of take a second and think about all of those people who are not working and all of those people who are being subject to, as Laura called, some of these issues that arise from all of the money in politics and all of the inequitable tax situations that we have. And it's the coffee party is one of the legs of the stool that fights for you on those things. So a grassroots dollar is a grassroots dollar is a grassroots dollar. So if you can take a minute and come and donate for us, we'd very much appreciate it. Again, it's at coffeepartyusa.com, and just click on the donate link. So for everyone in the coffee party, for Eric and myself, I want to thank you for spending this time with us once again on the Middle Ground. And next week, I'm sure we'll be doing debriefs of both conventions. Eric, any last words?
Well, it's awfully noisy, I apologize, but, I was reminded of Will Rice, who came out of the closet as a member of the 1%. He's a, he inherited a good deal of money, and he said his job essentially is to go to the mailbox and open it up and take a check and deposit it. And he just wonders why it is that we have work taxed at a rate that's higher than the money that he earns by going to his mailbox, opening it up, and then taking the check to the bank. And I think the answer is that the laws are being made by people who pick up those checks. And we need to change that. We need to increase the participation in our democracy to a point where laws are being made by working people as well. And that's why we should all be registering to vote and participating in the election this year.
Absolutely agree. Whether you believe that the taxes are fair or not, or that money is earned or not, the one thing we can all agree on is that we should all be represented and we should all vote, and it should be one voice, one person, one vote, not $1, one vote. I want to thank everybody again. Eric, enjoy the rest of your time there, and good night.
Thanks, Michael.
Time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on the Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.